dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're listening to episode 654 of Unwelcome Guests, State Crimes Against Democracy. I'm Robin Upton, and we're going to hear in just a minute from Lance DeHaven Smith an interview in which he explains why he coined that phrase, the state crime against democracy, why he feels it's important to explore the systematic crimes carried out by those with their hands on the levers of power, of the state in particular. But yes, it's the same bunch fairly much who control big business and a lot of other hierarchical organizations. Now, what he shares with our other speaker this week, Paul Craig Roberts, is an exasperation at the apparent inability or unwillingness of the average American to seriously address what is going on in the country, what has gone on, a refusal to look seriously at the evidence. This is a 90-minute interview, and thanks to Len Osanek of Black Op Radio for this. There's a huge number of shows on the JFK assassination and other similar events. If you'd like to find them, they're all available for download from blackopradio.com.
Today we are speaking to author Lance DeHaven Smith. Hello, Lance.
Hello, Len.
A pleasure to speak to you today. We spoke before a couple of years ago about a previous book, but today we're going to be talking about your new release, Conspiracy Theory in America. It's an interesting topic because with the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, there still seems to be denial in the mainstream press and almost a belittling of people who question things, who are inquisitive. They're labeled with this, and I guess you point out, a CIA invention, the word conspiracy theory.
Yes, it's an amazing story, really. I call it the conspiracy theory conspiracy because you had this intelligence agency contacting the media contacts around the world and telling them that people who questioned the Warren Commission findings were conspiracy theorists under the influence of communist propagandists, and created this pejorative term that now is taken for granted as if it was a name for something that's obvious, that anybody who questions these things is paranoid or harebrained, and it's something that we need to be aware of. I don't think the CIA has just invented this one term. I suspect that our language has been manipulated fairly extensively, and they're probably much better at it than they were 50 years ago.
Right. Now, what was the catalyst to get you writing on this topic?
I was in Tallahassee, the capital of Florida, when the 2000 election took place, and I saw then that the election was effectively stolen by the people who were responsible for administering the election laws. I thought that this would be investigated later. My assumption was in the heat of the moment you would have some things happen and people could get away with things, but soon that this would be looked into and actions would be taken to penalize these people, put them in jail. There were two supervisors of elections in Florida, two different counties, that were declared in court during the recount to be guilty of manipulation of the process to help ballots be counted by Republicans. And nothing happened to these people. They should have been removed from office, but the governor was George Bush's brother and wasn't going to do anything and didn't do anything, and nothing happened. I saw all these things. There were many things. The general counsel for the governor's office called the five largest law firms in Florida and told them not to work for Gore. Well, That's a felony. That's a use of public office or coercion. And nobody did a darn thing. So I started thinking about political crime. And at one point, I wrote down a list of the assassinations and the election fiascos and problems and the wars that were based on mistaken intelligence, supposedly. And it was a long list, and it shocked me. I went back and looked at some of the earlier writing during World War II. There was a famous historian, Charles Beard, who wrote about Pearl Harbor, that FDR, the president, knew the date of the attack and where it was going to be and didn't tell the military commanders in the Pacific. But this had all been repressed and lost to memory, really, in American history. So I started studying. I coined the term state crimes against democracy to come up with a label for this crime. But what had happened with the conspiracy theory label is you're directed away from the crime itself, and the focus is on the speculation and the people who are speculating about it. You have to name this crime. So that was the first step. What the founders would have called it was high crime, treason and high crime. But those are antiquated terms for us today, I suppose. And I wanted to give it some content, so I coined this term. And I got an article published in 2006. I wrote a book on the 2000 election called The Battle for Florida and chronicled a lot of the crimes. But it didn't do anything. You're really kind of shouting into the wind. The political class in the country is so eat up with special interests and the secrecy and the tendency for the political class to feel that anything that threatens the reputation of the leadership is dangerous to the country and therefore itself a form of a treason or something close to it.
Well, yeah, you make a reference at one point where, it's like the elephant in the room. Everyone's walking around this. Everyone seems to have this knowledge that the mainstream media, especially Fox News, they have this agenda, Pavlovian-like, just ringing the bell saying everything's okay. And yet, as you start looking into these things, you think, did we really know about Pearl Harbor ahead of time? And this is documented. I mean,
yes.
You mentioned an author. So this is a setup job,
Oh, yes.
We know they're coming.
Yeah, I think there's part of it is there's a natural inclination to not want to want to trust your leaders and that kind of thing. But Americans are historically very cynical and very skeptical and very untrusting of leadership. That the Declaration of Independence was a conspiracy theory, the way we think of it today. It declared that King George was plotting against us. There have been conspiracy theories about our presidents. Our presidents have had conspiracy theories in the 1800s. So naturally, Americans should be skeptical, and the fact that they're not means something significant has happened in our civic culture. And part of that, it's very hard to track these things. I did find a CIA dispatch, it's called, a memo about this conspiracy theory concept and telling people to the CIA agents to contact the media friends that they had and talk to them about this.
Yeah, they're assets in the media.
Yeah, they're assets. And this is the tip of the iceberg. You've got to assume that very little of this has actually gotten out. But I did find this one example, and it was frightening. It's interesting. The first part of it said that the questions about the Warren Commission challenged the entire leadership of the country and the entire institutional framework. And it was very, I really have the sense that the leaders think that they're the country and that the government is sort of an enterprise that must go on and that they're protecting it from us. They don't view it as our government. They view it as their government. And so that they don't think about the fact that when they deploy this ridicule of the people's suspicions, that they're undermining the very heart of democracy and our institutions.
That's a very good point, you know, because you do get that. How dare you question these honorable men, and they're given that title, and Jim Garrison said, I'm not impressed just because the guy has an honorable title now, because I've seen what goes on in Washington. And that was kind of a wake-up call for him. He was quite surprised. He said, this doesn't appear to be the same country I was born in. Now, there is this ridicule, and now the label, conspiracy theory, as if it's theory. It's not any kind of political research. We have
exactly.
researched the topic, and we have found this is what is going on as a fact. And we'll get to maybe the JFK assassination in a moment, but just in your book, you have really researched what has gone on with the Secret Service, and these are facts. So it's really it's strange how America has gone to sleep. It reminds me that when all these tanks and everything rolled out in the streets of Boston, there was people all cheering them. So, yeah. You found that guy. You know, USA, USA, right? You know, lock us back up in our house for the weekend and catch one guy.
Yeah, I think it's an astounding development that since the Kennedy assassination, you've had this transformation of our civic culture from a culture that was skeptical of leaders and wanted to be very careful with them and divide power and require checks and balances and have oversight And now those kinds of sentiments are considered nuts. And that happened in a very short period of time. I think part of what we have to come to grips with is that these people are very good at what they do in terms of manipulating our language and our beliefs and our perceptions. And part of talking about conspiracy theory is to get people to recognize that term did not exist in American discourse prior to 1964. It came out suddenly, and now it's taken for granted. And we've got to go back and ask ourselves, how did this happen to us? Part of the wake-up call that has to be made is for us to become suspicious of our own language. And that's a hard sell. One of the issues that I raise is whether 9/11, that term, was planted. It's a strange term. We've never named an event like that after a date. We don't call the Kennedy assassination 11/22. We don't call Pearl Harbor 12/7. We call these events after the location, Pearl Harbor, or the event that happened, the assassination of President Kennedy.
Sandy Hook.
Sandy Hook, right. But this, suddenly we call it by a date. And what that does is define events as before 9/11 was different from after 9/11. Everything changed, is what Jamie had said. And so it causes us to really accentuate this event. If we were to say everything changed after the Twin Towers collapsed, that doesn't have the same feel as everything changed after 9/11. 9/11 is a date. And so I want us, scholars and people who are interested in this and that are tracking it, and you've done enormous work, Lynn. I'm kind of an interloper here. But one of the things that I'm suggesting that we do is really be cautious about our language and look for things that are out of place. The conspiracy theory concept, when you think about it, it's dumb. I mean, what it's labeling is saying that just because you've got something called a conspiracy, it's a suspicion that's wrong. But the reality is the only conspiracy theories that are considered bogus or problematic are ones that contradict what the government says. So it's not the form of the suspicion, the fact that it's concerned about collusion and a secret plot. Nobody has a problem saying that about Watergate. It's only about our officials And so the term is meaning, you know, it's a bizarre twisting of the meaning of the term. And it's empty, but think how emotional it is now. I mean, the easiest way to shut down a discussion is to call somebody a conspiracy theorist. End of talk.
Yeah, a conspiracy theorist, as if that's all they have time for in the day, is to look for things that aren't correct. And then they come up with a theory. And
right.
I think people tuning into this show, I think that the Kennedy assassination is a very good example because it's been described as an hourglass, and there's the aftermath of the assassination, the apex there is the event on November 22nd, and then there's the all the events that shaped the removal of Kennedy, where people said, this guy's got to go, and we've got to do it quick, and they tried maybe in Miami, they tried in Chicago, it appears, and they, you know, finally got it right. Or I shouldn't say that way, but they pulled it off in Dallas. And I think that because Kennedy was so forward-thinking, he was really thinking for the America and the world, and he was, you know, a visionary that way, that's why he's so sadly missed in all.
He wanted to end the Cold War. And the military, that was not the policy of the military. Their policy was containment and confrontation and expansionism. So they saw Kennedy as a complete threat to their agenda. He had backed down from their point of view in the Bay of Pigs, not sending in air power. And then they wanted a first strike against the Soviets during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Kennedy had the good sense to stop that. He had signed, right before his death, a treaty ending the testing of nuclear bombs in the atmosphere. There's a film, The Fog of War, that interviews...
with Robert McNamara.
Robert McNamara, I'm just blocking on Robert McNamara, and he says in there about this ban, he said the military leaders said that the Soviets would test it on the black side, the dark side of the moon. And McNamara thought that was ludicrous and ridiculous, but he reports it in this movie, and so apparently... You know, they thought we were trading away our superiority with nuclear weapons. So they had a lot of reasons to take Kennedy out. What's remarkable to me is this stuff is in the Warren Commission report. I mean, the fact that they took the body at the opposition, the medical examiner said that law required an autopsy there in Dallas, and they took the body by force. They put it on the plane. They could barely get it in the plane door. There's pictures of them hauling it up the ramp, the stairs, and it was, you know, it wasn't workers. It was people dressed in business suits who were, you know,
right, making a getaway. And, you know, you mentioned there was quite a scene in Parkland Hospital getting that body out.
And this is in the Warren Commission report. So, I mean, we should have said immediately, hey, what's up with this? The vice president who becomes president runs away from the scene with the body. He won't leave town until he's sworn in, like he's afraid to land in Washington without having to...
Being arrested, right?
Yeah.
If he was arrested for... Well, my point was, getting back to that people who may think that some of these things like, was 9/11 an inside job? Did we really know about Pearl Harbor ahead of time? I could go on and on. The Kennedy assassination is a grand example here of what's going on. How you look at what FBI agents reported to Hoover, all their findings, and then you see the final report, they don't match. You can see that, as you're mentioning, that certain facts are the facts and they can't be changed, but yet the conclusions are not supported by the facts. And it's unbelievable that they have these fight for the body. You know, they say, no, you're not having it. Because we know what's going on here, this is a crime. We don't want everyone in Dallas to know of all the different points of bullet entry and trajectories.
Right.
And as you point out in your book, you know, they started washing the car right away. They started changing.
Yeah, that was amazing. A lot of people have observed this before, but I was stunned that they washed the car at Parkland Hospital, the limousine that the president was riding in, and that blood spatter evidence. You know, you've seen all this blood and the brains and the skull bone on the trunk of the car. Everybody would have known. No, he was shot from the front. But they washed it. Now, that's destruction of evidence. That's a, you know, just abandonment of the crime scene and destruction of it. You know, there are photos of this. So, you know, it's amazing. It really is amazing the kind of audacity of these people, what they do. And I have to admit, it's amazing how gullible the American people have become about these things.
Well, you first started writing about the Florida elections, and as you started looking into the John F. Kennedy assassination, and you mentioned it was maybe all the details were new, was there one thing that stands out in your mind as just being jaw-dropping, something that
I think that the washing of the car and the absconding of the body, but part of it was, I was in the seventh grade when this happened. I remembered it. I was watching television on Sunday around noon, and saw live television with Jack Ruby shot in the stomach. And I remember talking to my mother and saying, you know, this is, you know, did they shoot him because he was going to talk? I mean, what's the deal? But this all gets kind of buried. I had gotten out of the military in 1972 when Nixon was running for re-election, and I really distrusted him. And then when Watergate came about, I thought, well, that just proves what a crook and a liar that guy was. But you know what? I didn't put this stuff together. I still looked at Nixon as kind of a rare instance of a scheming scoundrel getting elected somehow. I didn't look at it like, well, that's just the way power is in America today. I looked at the John Kennedy assassination as a bizarre event, and maybe it was, you know, the term conspiracy. I think we need to remind ourselves that that term suggests it's a one-of. It's a one-off, as the Brits say. It suggests that it's just a plot around this one event. And so instead of thinking of it as a serial crime where you connect John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others, and look for patterns in there, instead you're looking at one event and trying to figure it out. And the language has done that to us to some extent. So I'm ashamed in some ways that it took me so long to come to this. And like I say, I don't think if I had been somewhere else besides Tallahassee in 2000, I would have understood what was happening. I knew the law. I knew the election procedures. I knew the people involved. And I saw it with my own eyes. And that helped open my eyes to go back and look at historical events that I had experienced and seen and witnessed but had not understood the connections between them.
And that's so, the biggest thing, I think, for us to suggest progress and suggest change, we have to really know the crime. We have to really realize what we're up against, not just a bungling investigation or somebody by accident just washed the car and some. What did you do that for? That's a crime scene. No, you know, people are ordered to do things. And as soon as they're taking pictures of it, they put that car back away and they back people off. Don't let anybody get any pictures of this. Don't let anybody see the body anymore. We got to get out of town. I could go on and on, but I do like the idea that you've taken this through the American culture of where did the word conspiracy theory first pop up, and it seems to be a CIA invention to counter criticism of the Warren Commission. And then...
It lumps everybody together. So any possible theory from the most extreme, you know, the idea that the guy in the front seat shot Kennedy, okay, that's pretty hard to believe. But the idea that he got shot from a lot of different directions is much more plausible. The FBI covering up and so on. When you lump all of that together and you take the least plausible and condemn everything on the basis of that, it's a devilish term, a devilish...
Well, right, kind of, and, you know, Mae Brussel made a comment. She said, listen, even if I'm wrong about some things, if I forget the exact figure, but if only 25% of what we're talking about is true, we're in big trouble. So it doesn't even have to be 50-50, like you mentioned with the elections. How is it that these things go unpunished? And now when we, you know, study a little bit, thanks to Matt Tabby and some other people investigating Wall Street, what's really going on with our finances?
Yeah.
The whole thing is so crooked, you don't know where to start. Well, I don't want to get into that topic, but I like the idea. I like your topic of your book and the whole theme of it, running through this idea of belittling these investigations, not by any government agency, but by interested citizens who have said, I'm going to index the Warren Commission. I'm going to look into this. And you brought up a good point about these serial crimes, that if you don't think there's anything wrong with how they investigated JFK, you won't find anything wrong with the official government investigation of Bobby Kennedy or
right.
Martin Luther King. And they seem to go on like an old boys network that, you know, we got this under control. America, go back to sleep.
Well, and the truth comes out occasionally. I mean, some of it's apparent at the start, and we just block it out, and we're lied to, and a cover story is given, and people are silenced and ridiculed, and there's a distortion that occurs on the front end. But sometimes information comes out, but it's so late, it's so long afterwards, that it's very hard for people to go back and reprocess it. And it doesn't, you know, they find out, Gerald Ford, when the Warren Commission report was being put together, at the end, he changed the wording of the reference to the bullet wound in the president's back. But there was a bullet wound in the back and a bullet wound in the throat, and it was supposedly caused by the same bullet, which meant that it couldn't have been six floors up and behind him. That trajectory would have been higher in the back and lower in the front, and it was the reverse. Well, Ford rewrote it to say that the bullet in the back was at the base of his neck in the back, which it wasn't. So Ford, I mean, this guy, he becomes president. He makes a deal with Nixon to pardon him, not for crimes that he's committed, but for any crimes he might have committed. I mean, this guy is an unbelievable opportunist in all of this. But this doesn't come out until the mid-1990s, and it is news for one day only. And what we should have done is gone back and said, my goodness, this guy knew there was a cover story. He was an accomplice to the assassination after the fact, but guilty of the assassination by virtue of covering it up. We should take all the schools named after him and change the names. We should have an inquiry and publish all of this, what this man did. But instead, what we get is one day this is mentioned, and then life goes on.
And, of course, we're stuck with the label that it's just a conspiracy theory. You can't prove anything. And you get that from the Sixth Floor Museum. Especially like Gary Mack, who's saying, well, you know, privately I may think something, but I just can't prove it. So therefore, our official version is Dallas had nothing to do with it, and this was a lone nut. And you start investigating where they actually got this nut idea and, you know, Marxist and all that. I mean, the guy was an intelligence agent. The further you look into it, the darker it is. And this guy's on duty.
He defects to the Soviet Union, comes back with a wife. He knows Russian. He knows Marxism. He's stationed at the base where the U-2s are flying out of in Japan, and then he comes back and we ignore him. Sure, I mean, who are you kidding? But this is the kind of stuff that goes on, relatively routinely now in the United States. And people have, to a large extent, I think they've become accustomed to it. I think there's some people who actually think it's okay to manipulate things, that maybe that's the best thing for the country. It's a scary thought, but I think that some people, you know, their attitude is, well, they know better than us, the leaders do, and they'll take care of things for us. And what they're doing, you mentioned the economic, I mean, they're fleecing us. We've gone from a country with a large middle class to a country of the super wealthy and the working people and the lower classes, and there's more to come. And the banks, you know, banks are such a huge part of the economy now, and there's no accountability. Things are getting worse pretty rapidly.
I'm not sure if I saw it on some of your charts. You have photos and charts in the book, but it was the number of millionaires in America, you know, in the last 10 years, where that number has...
It's dramatically shot up, and at the same time, you have the withering of the middle class. and these banks that are too big to fail. I mean, I thought I had a comic line in the book about Nixon. I said he was too guilty to jail. But he, I mean, here was a guy who clearly had committed all kinds of crimes. He had sabotaged the peace talks in 68. If you look at the people who were killed in the 60s, I mean, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and George Wallace being shot, I mean, anybody that ran against Nixon got shot. So in any normal world, we would have been saying, this is the suspect. Let's go after this guy. And it's the same with the banks. I mean, these guys, the banksters, paid themselves multi-million dollar bonuses after wrecking the economy, a year after wrecking the economy. This is, it's an outrage, and I don't know where to start fixing it, but I think one place is starting to investigate these suspicious events, not with blue ribbon committees and the higher-ups, but with regular detection work. Control the crime scene, keep the evidence in careful inventory and a custody, chain of custody, and interrogate the people about their alibis and interrogate the underlings and anybody involved. Make a deal with the underlings to turn in the upper echelon in return for a lower sentence. It's just the way we treat any other crime. We've got to quit treating the elites as if they don't deserve to be investigated. They're the people who deserve to be investigated most thoroughly and most carefully because they control the apparatus of the administration of justice, and they can destroy evidence and intimidate people. So you have to go after them very aggressively, and you need brave people to do it. And we have right now literally the opposite situation. If it's a big bank or a very wealthy person or a very high-placed political official, they're presumed innocent even when all the evidence points the other way. And don't make the mistake of saying, well, we presume people innocent, and so we can't say they're guilty. There's nothing about presumption of innocence that says you can't be suspicious. There's nothing about presumption of innocence that says you don't investigate. You take people to trial, and you let the evidence be presented in a careful, orderly, balanced way. But you don't just shut down the investigation at the beginning because they're an elite and we're not going to raise questions about it.
It was like that with 9/11. It was unpatriotic to even question anything. And some talk show hosts and that were run off the airwaves if they said anything negative. So it's like, get behind your president, right or wrong. A couple of days ago, I saw some video footage of the Bush Library being opened, but there was a lot of protesters there as well saying this guy should be held as a war criminal.
Yes,
and there's a lot of countries that feel that way. And he lied and lied and lied. And now he's got his own little library and he'll retire. You know, but
and,
I think
and President Obama needs to, he swore an oath to enforce the law and protect the Constitution. And then he took office and turned a blind eye to the past.
Especially with whistleblowers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and this, and President Obama's a constitutional lawyer. He knows what he's doing. Now, I have a thing that I tell people in private when I complain about President Obama, and that is, well, he is still alive, which is somewhat remarkable in some ways. Now, in part, he's a very weak president, and he's done some things that have capitulated to the forces that be. But that may be, in his mind, what is necessary to continue in office in the way that, in an orderly way.
Yeah, isn't that a sad statement?
Isn't it? I'll tell you a story. I was on a beach, a deserted beach, with my wife when I first started writing about this stuff. This is in like 2003. I'm looking at the election. I'm writing this book on it and talking to her about these things. We're on this beach, and I said, you know, I think that they have covered this up. They've committed felonies. There are all kinds of crimes, and I'm thinking, going back and looking at these assassinations and things, it looks like we've got a criminal class that's running our society. And she says, shh, be quiet. They might hear you. And it took me a minute to realize it. wait a minute. I mean, that's how people do feel, that you could be, that you could be listened to if you were talking about these things. But isn't that an unbelievable thing to say? You're on a deserted beach, you're afraid of somebody, some government eavesdropping going on.
Yeah, Vince Landria called it a transparent conspiracy. And your chapter two is the American tradition of conspiracy belief, that this has happened many times, but somehow people are just, I don't know, immune, or they don't think it's important. And for some reason...
part of it was after World War II and the nuclear bomb and the Cold War fear, that was all hysteria. And it was ginned up by Truman and you know, NSC 68 really laid out a plan for keeping the people supportive of the confrontation with the Soviets and was worried about the people, the American people, not wanting to go to nuclear war. I mean, the reality is, why would you want a nuclear war? but the military's attitude was, well, you have to be ready for this, or you get pushed around by these communists. So they had this plan to manipulate the American people. And we really haven't broken free of that. I call it the end of the book. I suggest that we need a glasnost, an opening up, that the way the Soviets did at the end of the Cold War. They went through all their records and released a lot of information, and they told us things. You know, the October surprise in 1980, the meeting between some of our officials and the Reagan-Bush campaign people.
In Paris.
Say again?
In Paris?
Yes, in Paris, right, to get them to hold the hostages longer through the election. That was confirmed by the Soviet information out of their files. It also was confirmed, of course, by the Iranian officials later themselves. But we never had a cleaning of house like that after the end of the Cold War.
I just want to footnote that in case anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, that... George Bush went to have a secret meeting to say, listen, Jimmy Carter's going to try to get this thing solved, but we'll be a lot more friendly to your needs, and we'll supply you with arms and planes and everything at wholesale prices if you keep the hostages locked up until after the election. And then when Reagan's in there, he's getting his inaugural, and then he comes off and says, the hostages are on an airplane, and they're on their way home now, you know, like, I did it.
And that's the amazing thing to me is, you know, well, people should have looked at that and said, wait a minute, they let them go on the day of the inauguration? What's the deal here? That's pretty strange. But that to me is a lot of times what happens. There's obvious things, kind of dead giveaways, that we would normally expect people to say, hey, this really stinks. There's something totally wrong about this. We need to look into it. But instead, it just kind of goes by. Right over the top of people's heads and just keep moving on. The guy that was one of the people at the meeting was Bill Casey, who was the campaign manager for Reagan Bush for their campaign in 1980, and they made him the head of the CIA. Now, if that doesn't tell you something, and George Bush, of course, had been head of the CIA and becomes a vice president. You know, when we see Putin, who was a KGB officer, become the head of their government, we look at that as like, well, this guy's wired inside to all these scary, shadowy people, and we have to be very careful about what are the things he's doing to manipulate their economics and their politics. And yet we have a CIA director that becomes vice president and then president, and nobody bats an eye.
Now, you mentioned in your book, I know these topics well, but I'm always glad to pick up tidbits and things that I didn't know about at all. And you mentioned Richard Nixon visiting Moscow and someone asking him. We want to just recount that story?
Yeah, I found that. I did a, you know, now this is one of the great resources we have now is we can do word searches in the New York Times and Google has us an Ngram search system and some other tools that we can use. Well, I was doing a search for the term conspiracy theory and conspiracy in the New York Times, and I came to this article about Richard Nixon, who had gone This is after the Kennedy assassination, but before he's running for president in 68. And he's in Moscow, and a professor says to him, well, what are we to tell people, our students here in Moscow, about the American government and people after President Kennedy gets assassinated? You're a freedom-loving people, and yet this leader is assassinated and nothing happens. Nothing, you know, it's not investigated carefully. And Nixon turns around and says, well, I could ask you what happened to the head of your KGB, Beria, or what happened to Trotsky, who was assassinated. And the upshot of this was Nixon was saying, in effect, well, Kennedy was like Trotsky. He got on the outs with the ruling powers, and they took him out. And so that was the upshot of it. I found this article. There was a letter that a person wrote about 2 days later that was published in the New York Times that said this, that looked at it and said, gee, you're raising a parallel between the purge in the Soviet Union and the assassination of President Kennedy. That's rather telling. But that was news to me. It was a fascinating thing, and I thought of it as Nixon just kind of slipping up. But what it suggests is that he was part of an inner circle that decided Kennedy had to go, and this was set in motion by people at the, you know, it's not like a government decision. It's not like the Congress passes a law. There's an inner circle of people who may not even be in office at the time, Nixon being one when Kennedy is shot, and but it looks like that they were involved in a decision that Kennedy had to go, and it was a small group of people, but not a rogue CIA operation.
I think that he was against all of his cabinet and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and everyone. Kennedy and his brother were up against everyone.
And, oh, they were. Yeah.
Most of all, LBJ. And I think they were going to drop LBJ.
And that's an amazing thing to me. Nixon was in Dallas the day before the president, before John Kennedy's assassination, and flew out of town the next day when the assassination was occurring. And Nixon was interviewed in the papers, and he said Johnson was going to be dropped from the ticket. And this was in the headlines of the papers the day John Kennedy was assassinated. Now, to me, that is really strange. I mean, first of all, how did Nixon know this? That's a little interesting. But also, it's not typical for a vice president of a prior administration to say something about a sitting vice president that raises doubts about him or, puts him in an awkward situation. I thought, my suspicion was that Nixon knew the assassination was going to occur, knew that he would be a likely suspect because Kennedy had defeated him in very, very narrowly in a bitter, bitter election. Nixon says in Six Crises, his book about a lot of events in his life, that Kennedy, he says this outright, Kennedy put at risk the national security of the United States to manipulate the election dialogue in 1960. What he did was Kennedy knew the Bay of Pigs was being planned, but he said things in the first debate with Nixon about how they were weak on Castro and they weren't doing anything. And Nixon says in his book, well, I couldn't say anything. I couldn't say, well, we're going to invade Cuba. We're training people right now because this is all top secret. Well, he viewed Kennedy as a traitor in all of this. So he's got a guilty conscience. He's assuming that people will suspect him when Kennedy is killed. And he goes and does this interview where he creates a motive for Johnson, which was a true motive. It's true, but it's just weird that it comes from Nixon.
Let's talk just a little bit about the denial in the mainstream press, because you get, Tom Hanks now is doing, he was doing a mini series, and it's down just to one film now called Parkland, where he's taking the Bugliosi book, and Bugliosi is saying Lee Oswald did it after all. I mean, in spite of the evidence that we know now, 50 years later, it's almost unbelievable. It's like Tom Hanks saying that the world is flat, and here's my new movie about how
I
know
the world.
It
really is, and I encourage people to look at Bugliosi's book. I read it carefully. It's a huge book. But if you go to the details of it, what essentially Bugliosi is doing is presenting a prosecutor's case. I mean, he's not telling the full story, he's not telling the full truth, and he's shading truth. He has in a footnote, in a very important footnote, that we can see that Kennedy's head is thrown back by the last shot at his head, and his brain and stuff flies backwards. Bugliosi deals with this. He says, well, actually, if you look at it very carefully, you see that it flies forward first, and then it flies backwards. Now, the implication of this, obviously, is that there were two shots. So Bugliosi knows this, but he's burying it in a footnote and trying to turn it around to say that, oh, no, he had been shot from behind first, and then his head flew back. So it's a tendentious argument. I mean, it clearly is. But and Bugliosi's, you know, credible in a lot of other things that he writes about. I wondered about this book, about why he would write it, and I wonder
for the money.
You know, for the money, and it's a today it's the contrary point of view, ironically.
Right. And you mentioned, I think, earlier, accessory after the fact. And really, these things are, I think, you have a chapter called State Crimes Against Democracy.
Right.
I mean, having the sixth-floor museum there, trying to maintain that Lee Oswald is a lone assassin, I mean, it's unbelievable, and yet it should be a crime in itself. I'm not sure of the facts, but I think in Germany, you can't write pro-literature
right.
with the Nazi Party, you could be arrested
right.
if you're saying...
And let me tell you, after World War II, I have a few pages on the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. I wrote an article, a journal article, that I couldn't get published in the United States. The reviewers kept saying what I did was compare the Bush aggressive war plans and manipulation of intelligence and the conspiracy with Tony Blair to go to war with Iraq. I compared that to what the Nazis did in terms of a war of aggression and what the evidence we had against the Nazis and what we did. And so when I wrote this book about conspiracy theory, I said, well, look at what they did in Nuremberg. We didn't just try the generals. We prosecuted and hung journalists who had conspired, who were part of this aggressive war effort to get the Germans rearmed and to start a war with the rest of the world. We prosecuted and executed lawyers who knew better and who watched the parliament be taken over by this fake, you know, it was a false terrorism, a false flag terrorism attack that pushed Hitler into supreme power. They burned the Reichstag down and blamed it on a mentally deficient guy who was captured there.
From Poland? Yeah, it's a good point that did you hang the generals, but the lawyers and the people that went along as an accessory after the fact, they should be charged. And
that's what we should do with our own system. We've got, I think, when the journalistic class in the United States, this is not an ordinary profession. It is constitutionally protected. It has the First Amendment, and it is specifically mentioned as the press. It is expected to play a very important role in the system of checks and balances in our society. And when these people lay down on the job and trade what they know for access and shield the high officials, they are committing a political crime, a high crime. High crimes are not necessarily written into the law. There's not a statute that says journalists must tell the truth and expose things and find out and search and be objective and careful and hard-nosed and thorough. But that's the expectation, and when you betray the public trust by not doing your job, you are committing a high crime, and a high crime is punishable as a capital offense. I mean, this is very serious stuff, and what's happened today is journalists and public officials generally also do not take their constitutional responsibility seriously. And until we start prosecuting people for this, we've got to define these crimes, the state crimes against democracy, as a special crime and single it out like we do for war crimes or, or for hate crimes or for racketeering. You can define this stuff, and you can get it clear enough to where you can write it into statutes. And then we've got to prosecute and give some people some really hard sentences and maybe even execution. Now, if you don't have the stomach for that, you can prosecute them and then pardon them. But at least you've got to get it on the record. We've never had any of our officials go to trial. Nixon left office before there was a trial. There was a cursory investigation by Congress. They found these. They got these tapes. That's what did it, is that they had him on tape conspiring to cover up the Watergate break-in. But this guy had done all kinds of other things. If you read the transcripts of the tapes, it's pretty clear that he was involved or knew about the Kennedy assassination. Haldeman, his chief of staff, said that when any time Nixon referred to the Bay of Pigs, he was talking about the Kennedy assassination. So we've got to single out these crimes and target the people who are doing them and really get very seriously, try them and put it on the record. What we've done so far is just have a blue ribbon committee or we'll have a congressional investigation and then pardon the person and never go any
Well, they'll give some meager funding for an investigation, then they'll have it taken over, and it'll be, you know, headed by people who still think Lee Oswald was guilty, or in the case of Robert Blakey, you know, very naive to the whole thing, you know, almost pathetically, and thinking it's organized crime and the CIA would never lie to him, you know.
The American people should be, and I think are at some level, outraged that we have a crime like the assassination of President Kennedy that to this day has not been officially thoroughly resolved, and much less anybody brought to justice. People should remember, capital offense, there is no termination of the guilt. There's a term for it when you no longer are subject to prosecution. The statute of limitations. Well, there is none for capital offenses. There is none for treason. So the people that did these things that are still alive could be investigated today and should be investigated today. So part of what the glasnost in America, the opening up of America and going back and looking at all of these things has got to do is historically punish the people, or at least convict them and sentence them, and then if the president wants to pardon them, then okay, at least we have it on the record. But as it stands, it is very, very rare that you have a trial.
It's a little discouraging because you think that these guys are all well-funded, like whoever's funding the Sixth Floor Museum and Gary Mack to parrot the Warren Commission and not offer a real and, you know, authentic investigation or a real museum. It really is a joke. You'd think that'd be a place. Well, if we started laying down some charges of treason.
I mean, they've sworn. Most of these people will have sworn an oath. If they're a federal employee, they have sworn an oath to support the Constitution. The executive branch and the people in the military swear an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which is the president's oath. Many states, if you're a public employee, you swear an oath. Now, nobody takes those seriously anymore, but you've got obligations under that oath. And if you don't do what you're supposed to do, if you just lay down on the job and don't report a crime, for example, it's called nonfeasance, but it's a crime. And when you don't report a crime that you know about, you're guilty of the crime itself as an accessory after the fact. You know, the founders of this country, they took their oath seriously. Alexander Hamilton, when Aaron Burr was running for president with Jefferson, there was a tie vote at the end, and Burr tried to conspire with some of the people in the House, where the tie vote in Electoral College went to the House for resolution. And Alexander Hamilton went around saying, hey, this guy is not to be trusted. Aaron Burr is an ambitious person. We've got to watch out for him. That's why they have a duel, and Alexander Hamilton is killed in the duel. Now, Burr is subsequently prosecuted for treason for trying to break away the Western lands from control of the United States and start his own country. He's found not guilty because under the Constitution, treason requires an overt act with a witness. And all he had done was talked. But, I mean, this was the state of mind of the founders, that these were very serious matters. You swore an oath to protect the Constitution, and if you don't do it, you're subject to the highest penalties. And they would, you know, like Alexander Hamilton, they're willing to die to stand up for their beliefs. We're a long way from that these days. I think today we expect, you know, after Nixon's Watergate came out, these crimes came out, people would say, well, what did Nixon know and when did he know it? As if we had to find a smoking gun to do anything to this guy. The fact of the matter is, if you betray the public trust, you are subject to impeachment and prosecution. And so we need to get back to our common sense about power and the danger of power and what power does. Power corrupts. So when we see people in high office, our first thought is watch out for them. And we need to become much more clear and much more aggressive in prosecuting the betrayal of the public trust, even if it's not a specific law that's been violated. You know, when President Bush lied us into war in Iraq, that was a high crime. That was a treasonous thing to do. Many of, you know, thousands of our soldiers and airmen and Marines were killed, and not to mention all the civilians and the loss of property and the damage to the country and the damage to the institutions. He made a secret treaty, in effect, with Tony Blair. The Constitution says a treaty with a foreign power must be brought to the Senate for their advice and consent. They have to approve it. There was none of that. This guy ran roughshod over the Constitution and violated the fundamental organizing principles of our constitutional order. And that, we have to begin to see that that's a crime that is higher than murder. You know, there was a book on prosecuting Bush for murder because he had lied us into this war and all these people had been killed. Well, it's worse than murder. It's more mass murder. It's more akin to a genocidal or, you know, a large-scale war crime that is horrific. So we've really got to get a much more serious about holding our leaders accountable, and not just to little laws, but to in a real fundamental way, accountable to our system of government and their responsibility to represent us in good faith.
Well, yeah, in good faith, and that's just was not what is happening. So that's the conundrum.
It's a conundrum, but one of the things that I hold out hope for is government can change very rapidly when the people change. Think about the collapse of the Soviet Union. There you have a superpower with a very autocratic system of government that literally dissolves because people lose trust in it. And what happened in that case was the leaders themselves got afraid of the KGB and said that if the USSR continued, they would be continued plots by the KGB. If American people talk these things over, what you do on your show, bringing people in and discussing these matters and beginning to form a consensus that something is terribly wrong, that our system of government has been subverted by the people who are entrusted to administer it, that they owe us accountability, and that they, because they are in charge of the organs of accountability, escape all of the consequences of their behavior and enrich themselves and go off and write books and become wealthy for speaking and so on. By bringing people together on your show and talking through this and by other people in their homes and at the kitchen table, if we can reach a consensus on how serious this problem is,